Good morning, everyone. I now call this remote meeting of the House Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee to order, and we will begin by taking the roll.
Chair Long.
Present.
Vice Chair Akam. Vice Chair Akam. Minority Leader Swazinski.
Here.
Representative Bierman.
Present.
Representative Bow.
Present.
Representative Christensen.
Present.
Representative Franson?
Present.
Representative Grunhagen? Representative Grunhagen? Representative Hollins?
Present.
Representative Hornstein?
Present.
Representative Igo? Representative Igo? I believe he's joining now. I'll get back to him. Representative Lee?
Lee, present.
Representative Igo, I believe you just joined. Representative Lippert?
Present.
Representative Lislegard?
Present.
Representative Meckland?
Present.
Representative Munson?
Munson, present.
And Representative Stevenson?
We do have a quorum, members. We have three bills up today. And the first bill is House File 1255 from Chair Hansen. Welcome, Chair Hansen. I'll move that House File 1255 be placed on the general register. And I understand you have an author's amendment as well.
Yes, Chair Long. The author's amendment is technical in nature that our capable nonpartisan staff decided needed to be made. So I would hope you would move the A4 amendment to get in the shape of it.
So the A4 is the author's amendment. I'll move the A4 to get the bill in the shape the author would like. Any discussion to the A4? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A4 say aye.
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 Any opposed? The A4 is adopted. Chair Hansen, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chairman Long and members of the committee. This bill is the result of, I know, of at least 2 years of work that has been done with District Energy and Xcel Energy and members of the legislature to try to get a solution to the challenge of an ending power purchase agreement. So the reason this went to my committee first is we've had ongoing concern about Emerald Ash Borer and how do we properly dispose of ash trees. And we even had a joint hearing with the Ag Committee several weeks ago on this. We have a lot of ash trees that are going to be coming down in the immediate near future throughout the state. Every community, when we had Dutch elm disease, we replaced a lot of those trees with ash trees, and now they are susceptible to a pest. So District Energy and Xcel Energy worked out this agreement, and as amended, and this is what's in front of us today. I think it has strong bipartisan support. It is a limited term agreement, but it's something the legislature needs to do to allow this to move forward. So with that, I'd ask for your support, and I have two testifiers.
Would you like to introduce your testifiers?
Yes. I'm just getting a spam call on my call. So I don't know if Mr. Evans or Ken are going to go first.
I have Mr. Smith first on my list. So
Ken Smith with District Energy, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Smith, welcome to the committee.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members. I'm going to share my screen. And hopefully you can see that now. Ken? Okay, great. Thank you. So good morning, members and chair and members. My name is Ken Smith, and I'm the president and CEO of District Energy St. Paul and Evergreen Energy. And thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today in support of HF 1255. Since 2003, our company has been helping to manage tree waste in this region, using it as biomass fuel to generate renewable electricity sold to Xcel under a PPA and heat to District Energy St. Paul that is used to heat approximately 200 buildings, including the Capitol complex. One of the key reasons a new biomass combined heat and power plant was planned next to district energy in the 1990s was in response to the significant challenges the region had with dealing with Dutch elm disease and the large volumes of tree waste that it produced. Much of that ended up being open burned. The plan for a modern combined heat and power plant came forward that located the new biomass fueled plant next to district energy's hot water district heating system. That's the largest hot water district energy system in North America, so that the waste heat from power generation could be used to heat the community. The plant was purposely designed to use raw tree waste as its fuel as a means to solve this regional problem. And it then displaced coal at district energy, which was the predominant energy fuel source at that time. This plant has now been in operation for 18 years on a 20-year agreement, and it has been quite successful in managing the region's tree waste and generating energy from it. Today, we manage approximately 265,000 tons annually and generate approximately 153,000 megawatt hours of renewable electricity and about 50% of all of the heat needed for 32 million square feet of building space in downtown St. Paul. The electricity sold makes up less than 0.5% of Xcel's annual electricity sales in Minnesota. Now, to give you an idea of how much tree waste material that is, if we processed 265,000 tons into wood chips, it would fill approximately 12,000 semi-loads every year. And if you were to line those up end to end, it would stretch 150 miles or from here, the Capitol Complex, to Alexandria. Sorry. Today, hundreds of businesses and dozens of communities depend upon this facility to manage the tree waste, particularly as a new pest, Amaryllis ash borer, has emerged and begun the process of killing the state's ash trees. Since 2012, we've experienced a significant increase in the amount of tree waste we are managing in the communities where EAB is present. In the 7-county metro area, the amount of tree waste we are managing has doubled since 2012. And that is the challenge that brings us here today and the need for HF 1255. Our PPA with Xcel expires at the end of 22, just 21 months from now. Without a new PPA, this facility will not be able to continue to operate and manage large volumes of tree waste. This is a very thorny issue. As Representative Hansen said, we've been working on this for several years, and from all of our discussions over those years with agencies and interested stakeholders, there is currently no viable plan B yet in place to manage that volume of tree waste if this facility shuts down. And we really are out of time. There's so little time left. That's why we're seeking a very short 2-year agreement through the end of 2024. It would extend the operations facility for 2 more years with the conditions laid out in the legislature and the legislation providing certainty for the management of the tree waste, but also savings for the customers. During that time, we will work with the state and other stakeholders to determine alternative pathways to manage the tree waste and how best to pay for it. This legislation is not a silver bullet. This facility may not be a permanent solution, but it is in place and it's working today, and it provides a valuable bridge until other alternatives are put in place. This bill caps the cost per megawatt hour at a level of significant reduction from current contract levels. It is possible because the original contract will be completed and the capital invested to build the original plant will be recovered. The legislation also recognizes if the plant is to continue to operation beyond 2024, electricity prices must come down even further. In addition, we are very excited to partner with Xcel on how we can integrate meaningful electrification into district energy. Like Xcel, district energy has committed to being carbon free by 2050. And it's clear that electrification is going to be a growing part of our energy portfolio. So now is the time to study alternatives. In fact, we are already working together with Xcel to study alternatives on how we can integrate electrification into the system. So we're very pleased that the companion bill, Senate File 1047, is on the Senate floor, and we're hopeful that HF 1255 will do the same. Thank you, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you so much, Mr. Smith. Would you like to introduce your next testifier, Chair Hansen? Looks like you need to unmute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rick Evans is with Xcel.
Mr. Evans, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. I'm just have very brief testimony to supplement what Mr. Smith has already said. The current power purchase agreement, while it started in, I think, 2003, actually dates back to the 1994 biomass mandate that Xcel Energy had in statute. And as we come to the end of that, as Mr. Smith noted, we've been engaging in several years of discussions over what the next step can be or ought to be. This bill is the culmination of those discussions. As Mr. Smith said, it requires us to sign a new power purchase agreement, which will extend through 2024. The price of that energy will be high as compared to the market price of energy, but it is a significant savings over the price that we pay in the current PPA. So our customers will see savings. As the committee knows, these costs flow through our fuel clause directly to our customers, and so this savings is a direct savings to our customers from the current PPA. So we're definitely supportive of that. In addition, the bill provides a path towards this transition so that Xcel Energy will not be required to sign a new PPA, though we would not be prohibited, assuming that district energy can get their price of energy down to a point where it's competitive. And so we are looking forward to that as well, being the end of essentially purchasing high-priced energy. Finally, the bill, as Mr. Smith said, puts us on a path to studying either the partial or full electrification of the district energy system, which, at least in concept, would allow the city of St. Paul to be heated and cooled by 100% carbon-free energy as that plan develops. That plan is complicated. It is something that we have committed in this legislation to look at, of course, subject to approval by the Public Utilities Commission. And we look forward to our partnership with District Energy in trying to make that vision a reality. With that, I'll end my testimony and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. We do have member questions. And so we will take member questions first, and then we will go to the two amendments that have been filed. Representative Bull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got four questions I wanted to ask, but how does time look?
If they're concise, I think we can fit them all in.
Absolutely. They are concise. Currently, what is the share of metro waste, wood waste, that is burned through this facility?
Chair Hansen, or should I go to Mr. Smith?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowe, we don't know the exact percentage. What we do know that of our tree waste that we are handling on an annual basis, about 80 to 85% of it comes from the 7-county metro area. As you can see in the list in the testimony, we serve several counties. Material is brought to us from several counties, but we're handling a large percentage of the material that's in the region. We just don't know what the total amount is. Some of that material gets used as landscaping and so forth, but it's a significant portion of it.
Chair Hansen.
The other thing, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Bowe, is that the waste has to be chipped to avoid the ash borer. So hauling raw log from long distance not only is inefficient, but it also can transport the pest. So making sure that these things are chipped and the transport kind of reduces the travel shed for the movement of the wood waste.
Representative Bull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is there any guarantee that we'll be able to continue to burn this wood after 2024? And if not, what's going to happen to the metro wood? Because I'm not aware of a lot of other options.
This bill, Mr. Chair and Representative Bull, buys us 2 years to negotiate. We don't. Otherwise, the agreement ends at the end of 22, and that's not very long. So this buys us a little time, but there is no, Mr. Smith said, there is no plan B. Mr. Evans alluded to, we have to negotiate, and it's very, very complicated. So this buys us a little time, but not a lot.
Representative Bell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can tell you that the counties are very concerned about that. My last question. Would District Energy consider charging tipping fees? And that would allow us to drive that price for electricity down, I would imagine a fair amount.
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowe, it is something that we're looking at. Our experience with tipping fees thus far has been that people will try to avoid that. So they'll dump it in a variety of places to get rid of the tree waste. And it's also important to note that this tree waste comes at us from a wide variety of locations. It's dumped in city wood yards. It's dumped in counties. It's dumped in private lands. And so this material eventually makes its way to us, but from dozens and dozens and dozens of locations. So if you're going to have tipping fees, the question is, how do you implement that and where do you implement that? That's a challenge.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you call my name?
I did.
It broke up a little bit, sorry. Thank you very much. Thank you, Representative Hansen, for bringing this bill before us. Just a quick question to you. You know, we're talking about $98, which is a set price, and we're told that it's a significant cut. What is that a cut from in price?
Chair Hansen.
Yeah, Mr. Evans or Mr. Smith could answer that directly.
Mr. Evans.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. You know, the power purchase agreement is a confidential document, but we have, I think, been using a price which is about $150 a megawatt hour is a good representation of the price. So this would cut the price not quite in half, but close.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So does that reduction in price simply represent the capital costs?
Maybe I'll direct that to Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swazinski, it is two things. It's really capital costs. Also, the current PPA is very rigid. If you think about it, it was put in place back in the 90s for development of a facility when operational 2003. So some of what we'll be working on is flexibility in the operation of the facility, and that will help us also lower the cost. In addition, we are seeing, because of the large volumes of tree waste coming down, we are seeing the cost. There's more material coming to us and a big from closer in, and a big part of biomass cost is transportation. So there's multiple factors at play here, but the largest part of this is the capital is recovered from the original agreement.
Chair Hansen, looks like you'd like to add something.
And that price is a cap, so that's not the set price. That 98 is it can be an up to. Is that, I think that's correct, Mr. Smith.
And Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, that is correct. It's a cap, so if there are savings, they are passed through onto the customer. So the upside risk is with the facility. In our current agreement with XL, there is no cap. In this contract, there would be a cap, and so the downside is benefit to XL and its customers, but the risk is to the facility.
Representative Swazinski.
Representative Hansen, you know, you're in a unique position carrying this bill as environment chair. You know, obviously our state is facing a huge influx with emerald ash borer and the amount of trees within, especially within the metro. And I know you've spoken in the past, Chair Hansen, about, you know, utilizing potentially, you know, these cities are going to have to, you know, get rid of this. And essentially, in a way, ratepayers are subsidizing some of that removal of ash borer that may not potentially benefit, you know, if it's your neighborhood, we got to get rid of these ash trees. We're going to haul them to district energy, dispose of them. I mean, I really hope that there's some unique ways that we could essentially, you know, if because it's a cap, you know, if we could use legacy dollars, you know, those counties and cities are going to save money in the when they're getting rid of these trees on their boulevards, that we could maybe use legacy or some other accounts for tree removal or whatnot, and then that would potentially go into to cost savings. And wanted to get your thoughts on that particular area because you kind of bridged some unique gaps there with your chairmanship.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair Long. Thank you, Representative Swazinski. It sounds like, you know, almost like you were supporting the use of one-time general fund to help meet this emerging crisis right now. So Representative Lippert has a bill relating to tree planting. I think there's a variety of bills with emerald ash borer removal. We started 2 years ago to provide grants to the cities to help with that. There's been some inventory of ash trees work that's been done over the last 10 years by communities all over the state. The ash borer, ash waste is one of the things that keeps me up at night, and it's just going to be a massive challenge. And so I'm looking forward to working with you or anybody else and trying to find some ways to deal with it. You know, we've had members ask, well, what about mulch? What about baseball bats? You know, what about picnic tables, things that we could use? It's hard to comprehend the volume of wood waste that we're going to get. And some of that's going to come down in windstorms and in ice storms, Matt, where it's unexpected. It's not going to be staggered coming down. It's going to be emergency trees coming down. So we have a big task ahead of us that literally will touch every region of the state. It's going to take a lot of creativity, like you said. So I'm open to a variety of suggestions there. I'm going to be asking for funds and trying to put funds in, particularly to deal with this, to help the communities wherever they are on this, because it is a major challenge. This is one piece of it. And as we've discussed, this is a short-term, very short-term piece. And Representative Fuzinski, I think you can remember we've been talking about this for 10 years, and now the time for talk is over. We actually have to figure out what we're going to do.
Just one final one, Mr. Chair. And then, you know, just from a cost perspective, you know, that $98, how does that compare to, you know, industrial wind, industrial solar, community solar as far as a price variant? Maybe that be to Mr. Evans, I think.
Mr. Evans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, let me make sure that everyone understands I did take math in high school, and it's actually a third savings, not a half savings from our current PPA. So shouldn't try to do math. In answer to the question, you know, the price of energy is a difficult thing to pinpoint. You know, I think that the $98 would compare, for example, with a typical wind power purchase agreement these days coming in somewhere around $30, typical wind power purchase agreement coming in somewhere around $40. Actually, community solar gardens is actually more expensive than this particular contract. So that's about $110. So it's a little bit more expensive than what we would be paying under this power purchase agreement. So it is relatively high priced energy compared to other things we can get on the market, but it also is, as I said, a significant savings from the current contract.
Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a question for Mr. Smith. And this is going back to your discussion about the fact that our tree waste has doubled. And it sounds like it's going to continue to exponentially grow. Is this as a result only of pests and disease in the trees, or you know, what are some of the reasons for that happening other than, emerald ash borer?
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Christensen. Emerald ash borer is a significant component, but with the more intense storms, both in terms of wind storms and ice storms, you have communities that have more downed trees, and those downed trees need to go somewhere quickly. When there are major storms. And so it's not just emerald ash borer. And the emerald ash borer weakened trees are more susceptible to that. But we have a lot more wood waste coming in everywhere because of downed trees with these more intense storms, whether they're ice, wind, snow, et cetera.
Representative Christensen, did you have a follow-up?
No, that's good. It's interesting. Thanks.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have five questions to ask Mr. Ken Smith there. Okay. The first question is, who is Evergreen Energy and what role do they play in this?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, Evergreen Energy is a wholly owned subsidiary of District Energy St. Paul. District Energy St. Paul is a nonprofit. Evergreen is a for-profit. Its for-profit activities really are outside of St. Paul. So we manage an energy system for the Milwaukee Regional Medical Center. We manage a system in Duluth. We manage a system in Ohio. And so that is what Evergreen does. It operates and manages and develops energy systems. In this particular facility, our Evergreen Energy staff operate and maintain and manage the facility, but that is done at cost. Because District Energy is a nonprofit, the labor that we sell to District Energy from Evergreen as a subsidiary is done at cost. There's no profit to Evergreen Energy for operating this facility.
Representative Franz.
Thank you. Who is, Mr. Smith, who is Environmental Wood Supply LLC, and what role do they play in this?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franson, Environmental Wood Supply is an LLC. It's 50% owned by District Energy. It's 50% owned by a capital partner, DTE. And they basically process the wood waste. The wood waste comes in from a variety of sources, and they process it, and it's transported then to the combined heat and power facility.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Smith, who is St. Paul Cogeneration, and what role do they play in this?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franson, that is the cogeneration facility. It is a combined heat and power facility, and it is owned 50% by District Energy, 50% by DTE. So it is the facility that's producing the electricity and the heat, and it is the facility that then that entity has a contract for the PPA.
Okay. Representative Franz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Smith, who is DTE Energy, and what role do they play in this?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franson, they are the capital partner. So they, through a series of transactions, ended up with the ownership of St. Paul Cogeneration. They provide the risk on the capital, and they benefit from that. So they are the capital partner. They do not operate the facility.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Final question, twofold here. Mr. Smith, is it possible to get an organizational chart for these entities, and can we also get a financial statement for all these entities?
Mr. Smith.
That's a good question. We certainly can provide you, Mr. Chair, Representative Franson, we can provide you an organizational chart. These are private entities, but I can check on that for you.
Thank you. Oh, and also, Mr. Representative Hansen, happy belated birthday.
And happy belated birthday to you.
Thank you.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Most of my questions have been answered by all the previous questioners, but I do have one here for the bill's author. Thank you for bringing this forward, Rep. Hansen. And I just have a question on, you know, I looked at the chart of the expansion and the increase of how much wood is coming into the facility right now. Since 2016, it's almost doubled. And you've said we've been working on this ashbore thing a long time. Is there any way to forecast how far we have to go on this?
Chair Hansen.
I think if you looked at that chart and looked at the trend line, you can just follow it up, and it starts to move very large. We can get, Representative Bierman, Mr. Chair, we can get those details from kind of the ASH caucus, which I'm sure all the groups that are interested in green ash and black ash. So.
Well,
Representative Bierman.
Mr. Chair, Rep. Hansen, I'm definitely part of that caucus. This issue is very important for my community as well. And we're one of those 23 counties that are listed that are utilizing the facility. And, you know, we just have an issue here that we have to deal with it one way or another. I presume this two-year agreement, you know, one of our options in 2 years is, you know, to just go ahead and do this again for another extension based on where we're at, correct?
Chair Hansen.
That is, Mr. Chair and Representative Bierman, you are correct. This does not prohibit it. It would allow it, but at least it buys us the 2 years to work on it.
Representative.
And, yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then, let's see, I have one other question here. So if we end this agreement in 2 years, and Mr. Smith, maybe this is a question for you, with the increased volume of waste you're having, the next logical solution is to go back to burning it. Can you foresee that that's a viable option with the continued increase in product?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bierman, certainly you could. You would have to haul it someplace to do that. And again, it, the sheer volume, I think, is difficult to imagine. And transportation is expensive. That is the most expensive part about tree waste is the transportation of it. And so if you're going to haul it someplace and then dispose of it, that isn't free. There is a cost to that.
Chair Hansen.
Open burning is not a viable option like it was with Dutch elm disease in the 1970s and 80s. And just think of the climate consequence of the release of that carbon. And landfills, our landfills are filling up. So the volume, if we don't find some other type of solution, wood waste going to the landfills is going to fill those up quicker.
Mr. Chair and
Representative Bierman.
Yes, thank you for that thorough overview. And I just want to reiterate again your point on the increase of the trees coming into the facility being due in large measure to the increasing changing weather patterns and the storms that you mentioned. I think that's an important point we need to reiterate. Thank you for the bill. Thanks.
I don't see further member questions. We do have two amendments that have been posted. The first is the A1 amendment. Representative Swazinski, are you moving the A1?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair.
Representative Swazinski moves the A1 to your amendment, yeah. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you very much, members, Chairman Long, and the folks that are presenting this bill. You know, the AM1 amendment really is looking at, from a cost perspective, the reality is that this is exceptionally expensive energy. And while the bill does have, you know, an up-to provision, really trying to drive that price down for ratepayers. Obviously, this is probably the second most expensive energy on the books for Xcel Energy, way behind actually community solar. And the goal is really to keep this price going down. Obviously, this plant offers a service, I think, that has a unique perspective when it comes to metro and tree waste, but keeping that price as low as possible and getting down really to the nitty gritty is what this amendment represents. Moving it from $98 down to $80, I think, is a positive direction. I know there's an agreement on this, but I think we as legislators owe it to our constituents and to our the ratepayers of Xcel territory to keep this in mind. And I ask for a roll call, and I appreciate your support. Thank you.
Discussion of the amendment. Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Swazinski. I appreciate your concern on the rates. This is an agreement that I'm hopeful that we could pass in the House and the Senate and get it to the governor for signature. I should note there is a cost to wood waste. You know, we could reduce the rate here, but somebody's still going to have to pay for that waste. And so I would oppose the amendment. We've got a good deal here. It's taken a long time. It's not perfect, but it is what we need to do to buy us some more time and manage this huge workload that is coming.
Seeing no further discussion on the amendment and a roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll and the chair votes no.
Vice Chair Akam.
No.
Minority Leader Swazinski.
Swazinski votes aye.
Representative Bierman.
No.
Representative Bo.
Aye.
Representative Christensen.
No.
Representative Franson.
Aye.
Representative Grunhagen?
Aye.
Representative Hollins?
No.
Representative Hornstein? Representative Hornstein? Representative Igo?
Igo, aye.
Representative Lee?
Lee, no.
Representative Lippert?
Lippert, no.
Representative Lislegard?
No.
Representative Meckland?
Aye.
Representative Munson?
Munson, aye.
Representative Stevenson. Representative Stevenson.
There being 7 ayes and 8 noes, the amendment is not adopted. We have a second amendment that is quoted A2. Representative Swazinski, are you moving the A2?
I am.
Oh, Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm offering the A2, and I just want a roll call. That's all.
Discussion to the A2. Chair Hansen.
I would oppose the A2 amendment.
The A2 amendment is opposed. Members, it might be helpful just to describe the A2 amendment. Would you care to describe it briefly, Representative Franson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, the A2 prohibits a for-profit company from benefiting from this power purchase agreement.
Thank you, Representative Franson. Roll call having been requested, seeing no further discussion, the clerk will take the roll and the chair votes no.
Vice Chair Akam.
No.
Minority Lead Swazinski.
Yes.
Representative Bierman.
No.
Representative Bowe.
Yes.
Representative Christensen.
No.
Representative Franson.
Yes.
Representative Grunhagen.
Yes.
Representative Hollins?
No.
Representative Hornstein?
No.
Representative Igo?
Yes.
Representative Lee?
Lee, no.
Representative Lippert?
Lippert, no.
Representative Liz Ligard?
No.
Representative Mecklens?
Aye.
Representative Munson?
Munson, aye.
Representative Stevenson?
No.
There being 7 ayes and 10 nays, the amendment is not adopted. Representative Hansen, any closing remarks before we vote on your bill?
I would ask for your support, and if anyone would like to co-author, it'd be great. So thank you.
Thank you so much, and I just want to express my appreciation to District Energy and Xcel for working hard on this bill to come to an agreement. I know these are complicated issues with a lot of different needs involved, but this, I think, is an important compromise and sets us up for the long term. I'm excited about the possibility of seeing an electric district energy system in Minnesota, and would also note that the bill is being authored by Chair Senjum in the Senate and has moved out of his committee without opposition. So I'm hoping we can move this bill forward as well today. With that, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Long.
Oh, excuse me. I'll be a little more formal. I renew my motion that House File 1255, as amended, be placed on the General Register, and the clerk will take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Vice Chair Akam.
Aye.
Minority Lead Swazinski.
Swazinski votes no.
Representative Bierman.
Aye.
Representative Bowe.
Aye.
Representative Christensen.
Aye.
Representative Franson.
No.
Representative Grunhagen. Representative Grunhagen?
Aye, sorry.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hornstein?
Aye.
Representative Igo?
No.
Representative Lee?
Lee, aye.
Representative Lippert?
Lippert, aye.
Representative Liz Ligard?
Liz Ligard, aye.
Representative Mecklens?
No.
Representative Munson?
Munson, aye.
Representative Stevenson? Representative Stevenson.
I'm not sure we recorded Representative Grunhagen.
Representative Grunhagen?
No.
All right.
I have 9 ayes and 7 nays. Is that what you have?
I have on my track 11 ayes and 5 nays.
Oh, excuse me. With 11 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is passed. Thank you so much, Chair Hansen. So next we will be turning to House File 1592 with Chair Richardson. I will move that House File 1592 be laid over for possible inclusion. Chair Richardson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1592 would require energy grantees and utilities to submit an annual diversity report. This bill builds upon previous legislation passed in 2019 that required the Public Utilities Commission to convene a stakeholder group to examine the challenges and opportunities to diversify the workforce and the supplier chain to issue a report. There's a long way to go to build an industry that reflects the racial, gender, and disability diversity of our state. To address these issues, it's critical that one of the key important steps forward is to acknowledge that there is a diversity problem within the sector and measure its magnitude. We cannot track progress without establishing baseline data. In addition, measuring the scope of the issue can lead to better outcomes. For example, here in Minnesota, the Public Utilities Commission began requiring applicants seeking large wind energy conversion project permits to report on the number of local jobs created. And according to the commission, this has been successful in leading to the employment of more local individuals in building wind farms. Other states have also taken similar phased approaches to addressing diversity in the energy and utility sectors by starting off with the collection of baseline data with demonstrated success. For example, in 2014, the Illinois Utility Commissioners began requiring similar annual reports. With baseline tracking metrics, utility spending on diverse suppliers increased more than $1.4 billion over a four-year period with small, women, minority, and veteran-owned businesses. In 2016, utilities directed over $570 million to minority-owned businesses and over $2 billion to small, women, minority, and veteran-owned businesses combined. Aside from the spend data in Illinois, there has also been an increase in new diverse suppliers. More competition in the supply base has been shown to improve product quality and drive down costs. Furthermore, the annual reports submitted make it possible to identify what actions and strategies have led to success. Before us is also the opportunity to track the diversity of our workforce to obtain baseline information. And while this bill alone will not solve the diversity problem of the sector, this can be an important part of the strategy in conjunction with other bills within the body, such as providing training and pathways into careers for students and young adults. The barriers identified to collecting data are surmountable if there is a genuine will to want to advance inclusion and equity. And we also have the opportunity and ability to learn from other states that have prioritized this work to ensure greater inclusion. Today, I have with me Jose Perez, Jamez Staples, and Penn Pacer to testify as well.
Terrific, Chair Richardson. Would you like them in that order?
I will defer to the chair.
Oh, okay. I had a different order, so just wanted to check. Mr. Staples, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jamez Staples. I'm the principal of Renewable Energy Partners and Northgate Development. And this work here that you all have embarked upon is very important as we see that there is a need for more diversification in terms of the workforce in the energy and utility groups. If you do recall, last year there was some legislation that was put forth that required this to be taken up and overseen by the Public Utility Commission. And this work basically identified the fact that we do not have a workforce that reflects the communities that the utilities serve. In addition, we need to note we also have a strong need for to create these pipelines for younger people to start to understand the opportunities in the energy and utility space. I am in favor of the idea of basically keeping track of where we're at with this industry because it is absolutely imperative if we're going to have a workforce for tomorrow that we start to diversify. We do know that we see that the population of Minnesota is drastically changing. It can take a lot. It's starting now, and the governor has identified this as an issue with the K-12 system. And we see this as industry experts and participants see this as something that's absolutely imperative to start to kind of nail down and start to think twice about. And so with some of the work that we're doing with Northgate Development and Renewable Energy Partners, we are starting to try and create that pipeline and pathway to make sure that there is a diverse workforce in BIOP. And that's with one of the projects we are presenting for some funding for the purposes of developing the training center so that we can start to get the exposure at an earlier age for these younger people. So especially the fact that this has been successful in Illinois, I think it's absolutely imperative that we move forward with this bill. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Staples. Next, we will hear from Mr. Ben Passer. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chair Long and committee members. My name is Ben Passer, and I'm the lead director of Energy Access and Equity at Fresh Energy. As an independent energy policy nonprofit that is working to advance equitable outcomes across Minnesota's energy sector, Fresh Energy appreciates the important steps that are being taken in this bill. In these times of dramatic and transformational change in the energy sector, access to good-paying local jobs is especially important from an equity perspective. This imperative has only grown stronger as our economy looks to rebound from the downturn over the last year. According to a recent report from Clean Energy Economy Minnesota, our state had over 61,000 clean energy jobs in 2019, with thousands more in the broader utility industry. But over 11,000 of those jobs were lost during 2020. As these critical sectors get back to work in the months ahead, it's important to ensure that the energy workforce includes an equitable and diverse representation of Minnesotans, including small businesses, women, people of color, and veterans. With Mr. Perez, Mr. Staples, and other key stakeholders, Fresh Energy was proud to help lead the Energy Utility Diversity Group that was convened by the Public Utilities Commission in 2019. This process, authorized by the legislature during the 2019 session, opened a conversation on the future of energy jobs in our state. We believe that the strategies laid out in this bill will allow utilities and other interested stakeholders to better understand where the workforce currently sits and help inform goals for the future. Given the opportunity presented by this growing and ever-changing workforce, House File 1592 will continue this important conversation and help our state align economic equity with energy decision-making. Fresh Energy believes that all Minnesotans should have access to family-sustaining jobs working in energy. We are happy to support House File 1592 and look forward to participating in future conversations as this topic moves forward. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Passer. And finally, I think we are hearing from Jose Perez. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Perez. Mr. Perez, I believe you need to unmute.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Jose Perez, President and CEO of Hispanics in Energy, and also fortunate enough to help lead the Energy Utility Diversity Group on behalf of the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission to closely examine some of the diversity and inclusion issues facing the energy industry in Minnesota. That group included over 120 individuals, 40 stakeholder groups, including the utility groups, the investor-owned, the co-ops, and the municipals. Several community-based organizations, several labor groups, Fresh Energy and others. And so pretty comprehensive. We had a whole series of meetings. And so what we did is we basically dissected a lot of these components that are being looked at today. And I can share with you that the key instrument for this whole effort will be to take a look at how we are doing. So the data gathering information is a really key part of it. And all that does is collect information, and it tells the public how well they're doing. And as the state of Illinois was mentioned, the method there is a real simple one. So there's a big contract that's let out. The information is collected on the profile of the contractors, and then that information is used by the public to engage with that company. So that if somebody feels left out or if there's another opportunity, it causes discussion. So eventually, it's really interesting, any potential issues and disagreements tend to fly off because you don't have them anymore because there's more communication, more information, more transparency in the process. At the end, also, you also get better quality, more competition in the bidding process. And so instead of having three bidders, you might get 12 bidders because you're having more of an outreach opportunity. And at the same time, you're spreading out the economic impact to a greater group of the community. So it's more diverse because more people are engaged. And so the consequences, you've got a better forming government. And so I think that a key part of public policy clearly is one to take a look at how to treat all the public the same way. The methods that are spelled out in this bill in 1592 embrace that. They say, okay, we got to figure out a system of getting people to work together, and they're people from different population groups, different languages, different parts of the world, but they're in one community here in the United States, and so how do we make it so that everybody gets an equal shot at these opportunities? And so clearly this is a very important first step. You've shown a lot of wisdom last year with the legislation that you adopted to create our group 2 years ago. And so, you know, we strongly support, 1592 and urge your aye vote. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Perez. We do have member questions. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of quick questions. It seems, for larger utilities, this has maybe a fairly easy way to be reported, but we have a lot of small utilities in the state, some without, a lot of extra staff. Is there any considerations in the bill, or would the author be open to at least limiting to, if you're below a certain amount of customers and staff, that these requirements, obviously this is, has cost to it, and then also there's no fiscal note. Is there a chance the department can comment on that there is no cost to actually doing something with these reports within the department?
Chair Richardson.
Regarding the ability to continue to work on this, I think the plan today is to lay this bill over. So definitely open to more conversation in terms of looking at how we can move this forward. I think that it's really important in terms of lessons learned. We have the ability to look at how this has worked in Illinois, how it's worked in Ohio and California and other states. And I think that there's a opportunity for future discussion. Would be more than happy to have those conversations with you, Representative Swazinski.
I believe a fiscal note has been requested, but I'll turn to Ms. Beckel to verify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. From my analysis, I determined that there would not be a fiscal cost to the state. I have not requested a local impact note, if that is what you would like.
Thank you, Ms. Beckel. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just kind of a final, this could be to the testifiers. Obviously a lot of this bill is focused on employees, and we have a lot of government programs, especially like the community solar program, that goes out to try to find investors and put people that be interested in developing solar. Is there any interest from the testifiers to mandate minority ownership for those types of projects? Because we obviously have a lot of corporate buy-in, it's a 40-40-20, and then the 20%. Is there any interest in pushing, it's nice to talk about employees, but from a minority ownership of the actual production, would there be interest from those groups to put a mandate on those particular programs so that we could expand minority ownership of community solar?
Well, this is not a question to the bill, but I'd be happy to allow it. Who would like to take that?
I'd like to maybe.
Mr. Perez.
Yeah, let me share my thoughts on that. Clearly, economic development is a really key component. Business building is part of who we are as a country. And so, but to mandate it, I'm not sure if I would say a mandate is necessary as much as we need to have, incentives by the government to have people consider starting their own companies in this space. because I don't think there's enough of that that goes on. I mean, we're seeing it right now, not just here in Minnesota, but around the country. It's a real critical issue. And so clearly, I think it's a really noble objective to have diversity and ownership in the energy space. There's not enough minorities and women and service-disabled veterans that I can say that are owners of key energy operations companies that are doing contracts with companies in this space. And so we need to do a lot more. But there are some that do exist out there, and they're very large. And they typically tend to be the one companies that will go out and get multi-billion dollar contracts all over the country. And so there's some that are succeeding, but not a whole lot of them. And so if you take a look at the numbers of availability, very small numbers, but the opportunity is just tremendous. Certain communities are more entrepreneurial than others. But I think that, if we had the junior achievement program for minority students so that they could be incentivized, if you will, to consider starting their own business when they get out of high school or when they get out of college, I think we need to do more things like that. But, how you mandate something like that, I'm not sure exactly I know how to do that.
Looks like Mr. Staples would like to chime in as well.
So thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chair, to respond to this question. I guess what I would say is that I would probably echo Jose's comments in relation to the mandate. I think that there's a unique opportunity to start to build out the entrepreneurship programs, to start to encourage more young people to look at these industries as an opportunity for entrepreneurship. If they don't know that they can even get, if they don't even know there's an opportunity there, it's very difficult. I mean, to even work in the industry, it's very difficult for them to think about being an independent power producer. So I think we need to scaffold this out in such a way that will kind of get us there at some point, if that's what the committee chose to. But at this point, I think it'd be ideal to kind of it's ideal to dream, right? But we got to start to take the steps to get there.
Thank you. Good point. Chair Richardson, did you have any closing comments for your bill?
Well, thank you, Chair, for the opportunity to present the bill today, and I am hopeful that we can find a way to move forward, because this is just one way that we can ensure that we have a workforce and a supplier chain that is reflective of the state, and it takes us a step forward to really thinking about how we build that inclusiveness into our state, because we will be more prosperous for it.
Thank you so much, Chair Richardson. I appreciate your leadership in this space. The task force that was referenced that you carried last year, I think, was an important document to looking at the needs that we have in this space. And I'm certainly supportive of trying to help collect data, too, so that we can help move an industry that we know is growing and creating lots of new jobs to be one that is equitable for all folks in our state. Mm-hmm. And with that, House File 1592 will be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Chair Richardson. Next, we are going to be hearing Representative Lippert's bill, which has been posted to our committee website, the Minnesota Green Finance Authority. Representative Lippert, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For a long time, I've been interested in how we can do an even better job of mobilizing funds to create the changes that we need that improve people's lives, save people money, and address the climate crisis too. Though current energy efficiency programs and weathering programs make a difference, there's still so much more need in my district. We see this clearly in the Latinx communities in Montgomery and Northfield, in other households with low incomes in town, in households out in the country with straw bales around the foundations of their homes. How much energy is wasted, how much money that could be used for basic needs is wasted. There are farmers that want to do more with renewable energy or put soil health building practices on their land that will make their soil more resilient, improve water quality and their bottom line too. We need to plant trees, put in more renewable energy, create affordable, efficient housing and so much more, and we need to do it faster. So how do we leverage state funds to drive even more investment in these critical projects? Well, these kinds of questions led to an exploration of green banks. The state of Connecticut was the first to establish a green bank, and they did so in 2011. The Connecticut Green Bank has been very successful. It's used $250 million in public funding to create $1.6 billion worth of clean energy investment in that state. The state estimates it has created $200 to $400 million in public health value. And what's most interesting to me is that in Connecticut, because of their green bank, more households with low to moderate incomes have access to solar than families with high incomes. In other words, in Connecticut, the transition to the green economy is unfolding just as it should, with the cost savings benefits of clean energy going to those with the greatest need. There's at least 20 institutions of one form or another like this in 12 states. They typically leverage between $3 and $8 for every dollar they invest. They also quickly become financially stable, bringing in more revenue through fees and investments than it costs to operate. Often they are stable in 3 years. 2 years ago, I had a bill for a study of green banks to see if it would be a good fit in Minnesota. We know that the utilities, the Port Authority, nonprofit lenders, community banks, credit unions, and more are doing great work in Minnesota in facilitating energy efficiency, clean energy, and green projects, and still there are gaps. There are projects that go unfunded and needs that aren't being met. The McKnight Foundation picked up this study request and found that such an entity in Minnesota has a critical role to play in helping Minnesota meet its climate goals, spur economic development, and help us transition to a green economy in a just and equitable way. The Green Finance Authority in this bill can fill gaps and help strengthen and support existing programs. So this bill creates a task force to establish a Green Finance Authority as an independent nonprofit organization in Minnesota. I'll read from lines 4.1 to 4.5 that outline the purpose. When incorporated, the authority's purpose is to accelerate the deployment of clean energy and other qualified projects by reducing the upfront and total costs of their adoption, which it achieves by leveraging existing public sources and additional private sources of capital through the strategic deployment of its public funds in the form of loans, credit enhancements, and other financing mechanisms. The bill also outlines the task force membership, requires an audit, and appropriates money from the RDA account. There is currently momentum in Washington, D.C. to create a clean energy accelerator to capitalize institutions like this nationwide. Passing this bill will make sure that we are well positioned as a state to receive those federal funds. This Green Finance Authority is not a state bank. It isn't a public entity. It isn't really a bank. We followed the advice of the study and created an independent nonprofit that will be able to be capitalized by state and federal funds to provide creative financial solutions for the funding of projects that currently go unfunded. This bill is an energy efficiency accelerator, an equity driver, a key partner for helping us meet our climate goals in Minnesota, and it's an economic development tool as well. I have a couple testifiers with me today, and I'll start with Peter Klein from the St. Paul Port Authority.
Mr. Klein, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Lippert. I'm Peter Klein, Vice President of Finance with the St. Paul Port Authority. I don't get to testify very often, so thank you very much for this privilege. My testimony is really revolves around just showing the success that funds dedicated to investing in green projects can be implemented and really be successful. So the St. Paul Port Authority, first of all, just a background, we are by the legislature in 1932, so we are a subset of the state of Minnesota, and we are the largest port on the Upper Mississippi River. But our primary duty and function is to clean up polluted soils that the private sector won't touch because of the pollutions, and make them available to businesses to create jobs and employ people. We've had over two dozen industrial parks throughout the city of St. Paul, employing over 25,000 people at livable wages. More recently, within the last 10 years, we became involved in financing energy projects. And interesting to note that we just this morning were closing the financing to help District Energy, one of your previous testifiers. And I see Mr. Stables is still on this meeting. And we
helped his project and financed it through our financing programs. So we have a wide range of areas that we can fund. We started out about 10 years ago and received a $5 million allocation of American Resource and Recovery Act funds from the legislature. As we progressed, the Department of Commerce, who administered that grant, saw that this revolving loan fund was really a great use of the capital. To date, we've funded over 250 projects, over $100 million of projects with that $15 million allocated to us. And those projects are saving over 500 billion BTUs annually. Because of the success of Trillion BTU, Department of Commerce asked us to pick up pace and see if we could get it going in Minnesota. To date, we have 63 joint powers agreements with counties, so 63 of the 87 counties where we don't have a joint powers agreement, we just haven't come across a project yet. So we can always get a joint powers agreement. It really makes a lot of sense for the counties to sign up. We financed over 300 projects, over $150 million in those projects, and that program is saving over 500 billion BTUs annually. The $150 million puts us in fourth place in the nation. So we're behind California, the Connecticut Green Bank, which Representative Lippert mentioned, and Ohio. So we're doing quite well in Minnesota and would like to continue to hold our position. Combined, the programs save over 1 trillion BTUs annually. It's 100% financing. Our motto is we 100% financing, so no money up front from the property owner, and immediate positive cash flow. And PACE, because of the nature of the delayed payment, the first payment is going to be May 15th of the following year with the property taxes. Because of that delayed payment, that really does help it make the investment of positive cash flow for that business. Thousands of jobs have been created and tons of pollutants have been prevented. An example, I was just on a Zoom call this morning with Stevens County for a project in Morris. It's about a $1.8 million project. It's going to save over 100 billion BTUs annually and almost $100,000 in water charges as well. So just a significant project that's just using waste energy that's going into the atmosphere right now. The business is going to save approximately $500,000 annually. That's the kind of a great project that we're doing throughout the state of Minnesota, and certainly open to any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. Would you like to introduce your next testifier, Representative Lippert?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I invite Jeremy Kalin to testify next.
Mr. Kalin, welcome back to the legislature.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, and Representative Lippert. I'm Jeremy Kalin. I'm an attorney at Avizon Legal in Minneapolis. I help lead our impact counsel practice, where we work across the country with projects, investors, and companies focused on sustainability and social impact by mobilizing resources that can advance both enterprise and the public good. I've personally facilitated $293 million in clean energy projects for underserved markets, primarily through private financing made possible by small, discrete public actions, such as the access to the commercial PACE assessment that Mr. Klein was describing. Sometimes those actions do include project incentives, but often what they require are actually targeted technical assistance to attract the customer-friendly financing that's structured so that it really meets the overall needs and requirements of the project owner. In fact, I've learned over the years, as I know Mr. Klein has as well, that the first and most important question to ask is of any project owner, what keeps you up at night? What's your core business? How do we solve for that and drive economic opportunity for you? As a former legislator from rural and exurban Chisago County and as vice chair of the East Central Regional Development Commission, I've seen lots of these otherwise attractive investments and good wage jobs get left on the table because of the lack of dedicated technical assistance and because the existing financing and lending tools don't quite match what's needed to move that project forward. Some of these projects are water saving projects, some are energy saving, some are community scale reliability projects that can keep power on in times of crisis, and some are water quality projects like on-farm best management practices. The market segments I think that Representative Lippert's bill can help us unlock include affordable housing and rental properties both in the metro area and across greater Minnesota. Rural industrial energy savings projects. Mr. Klein just talked about one out in west central Minnesota. Farmer-owned clean water projects and lots more. The jobs impact is significant here. We're talking about 61,800 current Minnesotans who support their families through clean energy jobs. But we clearly have to do more to both capture this really fast-growing part of the industry, part of the economy, and to continue to make Minnesota truly the Silicon Prairie of clean tech. I just talked to water entrepreneurs this week that are trying to grow and need this kind of assistance to help spur that forward. You know, as I would just say that Representative Lippert described the green bank movement in other states, and this clearly is not a green bank, but it does respond to some of the successes and challenges I think that other states have encountered when they try to create new governmental agencies or large public programs where you have committed funding and you know, it becomes a challenge to maintain that funding through tougher times. The Green Finance Authority bill, what I really appreciate about it is that it provides only one-time quick funds, you know, and a pretty limited amount when you compare to other states our size, and charges that diverse group of experienced leaders to establish the authority as a private, self-sufficient, self-standing nonprofit organization. I think the other key piece of this Minnesota solution to continue to grow these jobs and these industries is recognizing the good work that's already being done by utilities, by public entities like the St. Paul Port Authority, by private community lenders and investors like the Center for the Energy and Environment, by credit unions, including their CU Green Initiative, and by banks like Sunrise and Bremer Banks, just to begin among the dozens that are participating in the clean energy economy. As I understand it, we might need a few tweaks here and there to continue to ensure that, that the gears mesh up really nicely. But in general, my experience over the last 15 years in this space suggests that Representative Lippert's Green Finance Authority bill can be a huge difference maker and accelerant to both removing junk from our air and cleaning up our waters and making our grid more reliable and truly spurring more economic development across the state.
Thank you, Mr. Kalin. We do have member questions. I have one that I'd like to start out with. I just want to note that this, I think, is a really exciting idea and one that I've, in my experience, seen is much needed. Before I was in the legislature, worked on a very local neighborhood solar project that was just in my community. And we talked to three or four different banks and couldn't get anybody interested in us. We were too small, you know, to be on anybody's radar and to really get lending from traditional sources. And so having an authority like this, I think, would have been the perfect fit for a project like ours that was just not going to be of interest to any real bank and fell beneath that threshold. And the question I have for Mr. Kalin or Representative Lippert is, we have a blank note for the fiscal cost at the moment allocated from the renewable development account, and was curious if you had thoughts on what would an initial seed fund need to look like. And then Mr. Kalin, you mentioned that you'd think this would be a one-time expense and that the authority could stand on its own after that. And if you could speak to that, maybe I'll start with Representative Lippert and then go to Mr. Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, I think the situation you were described is exactly the sort of gap that the Green Finance Authority can fill. And in our discussions, we've been talking about a seed fund amount of $10 million. And I'll turn to Jeremy Kalin to talk a little bit more about what that could do.
Mr. Kalin.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Great question. You know, the we've seen, as both Representative Lippert and Mr. Klein discussed, that leveraging the $10 million, we focus on primarily using it to provide the kind of loan loss reserve or other risk, very, very targeted risk strategies to attract private capital at scale. So we've seen everywhere, I know the public literature says 3 to 8 to 1 for every dollar invested. I was just looking up a project on which I was involved up in Chisago County with the Chisago Lakes community drove, where it was a $12,000 investment resulting in $2.8 million of clean energy projects. So I'm hoping that we can replicate that kind of success, and also ensuring that as a private nonprofit that has to become self-sufficient, that's one of the great parts of this enterprise-driven structure, the nonprofit will have to charge a little bit of an economic development project fee, as is best practice across economic development. So whether that's, you know, small or the full 2%, it's, I think that's part of letting the market really determine what the appetite is. But obviously, as a nonprofit, as a 501c3 tax-exempt organization, hopefully, and a 317A not Minnesota nonprofit, we hope that that foundations will be interested in supporting some of those targeted pieces as well. So hope not to be back at the legislature for anything other than very specific public demands if the leadership and the board and legislators all decide that, hey, this is a need that we should invest in the authority again later. But I don't see that as being happening in the first few years at the very least.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and it's great to see you back, Representative Kalin. And I my question relates to some of the specific kinds of projects that are envisioned that can be funded in this. I know that Mr. Klein had mentioned a couple, and I'm very familiar with the solar project that the chair had referred to. But Representative Kalin, Mr. Kalin, can you maybe just give us a little more sense of the very specific kinds of projects that can be funded and have been funded through some of the financing arrangements that you envision, including energy efficiency that I know you had championed while you were in the legislature?
Mr. Kalin.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hornstein, my longtime colleague. Thanks for your champion on these issues, championship and work on this. You know, I think the Chisago Clean Energy Hub is actually a really interesting example from about 5 years ago, where we ended up actually going door to door on Main Street and with trusted members of the community, enlisting small business owners to get a simple energy audit at no cost and identifying. I was kind of shocked actually to find that in the municipal liquor store, I won't name the community, that there were the big fat T12 1.5-inch fluorescent lights that give off more heat than light inside the beer coolers. So really obvious solution where you can, you know, reduce the energy demand by installing LED lights and also, of course, reduce the cooling of those freezers or those coolers. Excuse me. Nobody wants frozen beer. And so, you know, that kind of trusted peer-to-peer work and then having lending tools available and saying, here's the utility rebate that's available today, and here's the lending resource from Center for Energy Environment's one-stop lighting shop. Great example of bringing it all together, but without that targeted technical assistance and outreach that's trusted at the community level. You know, that's one really interesting Main Street. I'd love to see every community in the state take on that project together. The authority certainly could make that happen. And then very quickly, I'll talk about where low-income rooftop solar projects, we've been able to catalyze private investment where they're able to take advantage of the tax credits. And if the homeowner can do so, awesome. If they're unable to do so because of the goofy structure of those credits at the federal level, then we're able to actually attract entirely private investment, hiring people of color to do the work on those rooftops and build on-the-job training opportunities at scale per Representative Richardson's really important prior bill. And so it's exactly kind of pulling together those pieces of the puzzle. And I could talk about water quality projects, so doing on-farm nutrient reduction projects where the downstream city could at less cost clean up their discharge and get an MPCA permit to then fund the projects upstream, like the Nature Conservancy has been exploring on the headwaters of Mississippi. Lots of different ways where that just that technical assistance is needed to kind of pull it together and make it sing from the existing resources. And that's just that gap filling is missing in some key markets.
And Representative Hornstein, I'll mention quickly that one of the opportunities in the McKnight Foundation study had to do with electric buses.
Representative Lippert knows what I'm thinking about. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lippert, for bringing this forward. I think this is really exciting. Before coming to the Minnesota House, I was on the Minnetonka City Council, and in my time on the council, we developed a joint powers agreement with the St. Paul Port Authority for commercial PACE. And while I don't fully understand all of that, my question is about, are there opportunities to work collaboratively with these two organizations moving forward? And maybe that was what Mr. Kalin was just kind of referring to, but will there be opportunities to maybe partner with the St. Paul Port Authority and be able to use this funding mechanism to take those investments and that targeted in those areas to go even further? And is that part of how this is intended to work?
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Akam. It's certainly the intent of this legislation that the Green Finance Authority would be strengthening existing organizations like the St. Paul Port Authority and the great work they are already doing, not supplanting, but strengthening and then filling in some other gaps. And perhaps Mr. Klein has some thoughts on the ways that a Green Finance Authority could be a good partner going forward, properly constructed.
Mr. Klein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lippert, and Representative Akam. As I see it, the ARRA funds are our primary source of initial financing, and ARRA funds are restricted and loan loss reserves are not allowed. There have been occasions throughout the time period that we've been implementing Trillium BTU that I felt that loan loss reserves could be a partial solution to some of the financings. The other areas, we're working with the city of Hibbing that is looking to change over from a steam plant, a very inefficient steam plant. And all of the businesses and housing within Hibbing need to switch out their systems. And we haven't been able to figure out how we can use PACE effectively. And I think that that's the kind of a gap example that hopefully this new financing authority could help us fill.
Representative Akam, any follow-up?
No, that's fine. Thank you. I appreciate the clarification.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Klein, I'm wondering if you can explain the Port Authority's fundraising for District Energy St. Paul.
Oftentimes we act as.
Mr. Klein.
I'm sorry.
This is not to this bill, I don't think, but since it was relevant to a topic today, we'll allow the question. Mr. Klein.
I apologize, Mr. Chair and Representative Franzen. The St. Paul Port Authority acts as an issuer of bonds. And so the current pricing that is closing, or hopefully closed a half an hour ago, it was to finance improvements to the district plant and also to repairs to the system, the pipes that go to the various buildings throughout the city. So we are an issuer for those tax exempt bonds, and that's our primary function. Over the years, I've issued probably several hundred million dollars of bonds for district energy over my 24 years at the Port Authority.
Representative Franzen, did you have a follow-up? Okay.
Well, thank you.
Don't see additional member questions. Representative Lippert, closing remarks to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank everyone for their time and so many partners for their good work on this bill as we've been crafting it. So many stakeholders have been involved. We'll continue having conversations to make sure this is doing exactly what we want it to do. But this, I think, can be a key tool for us in filling needed gaps and strengthening existing programs. It has great potential. I'm very excited about it and look forward to talking more.
Thank you so much, Representative Lippert, for presenting your bill. We don't have any further business before the committee. We will be meeting next Tuesday, March 4th at 10:30 a.m., and this remote hearing is adjourned.